This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Straight from the source tonight, day one for criminal defendant Donald J. Trump. The former president making history for all the wrong reasons, facing prospective jurors who could make him a convicted felon, and dozens dismissed almost immediately. In fact, not a single juror was picked today. We'll take you inside the hush money trial. Our source tonight, Maggie Haberman, had a bird's eye view of Trump, the lawyers, the jurors, and the judge. I'm Caitlin Collins, and this is The Source. Imagine showing up for jury duty and finding out that you might have a front row seat for the next several months to be the first criminal trial of the former president, and that you could be one of the people who will decide if Donald Trump should be a convicted felon and potentially shape his political fate. And while you're being questioned, there is the guy sitting right there whose stock and trade has often been intimidation throughout his career. Well, that was what greeted 96 Manhattanites on a beautiful spring day here in New York today. It's a bit chillier, though, in the courtroom. At one point, every available seat in that courtroom gallery and the jury box was filled. But at about the time it takes to say hush money, at least 50 prospective jurors were told that they could leave. They had raised their hand and said they could not be fair and impartial in this trial. Judging from today's proceedings, it could take a while to find the 12 who believe that they can, and a few alternates. As for Trump, our CNN team inside the courtroom tells us that he was actually biting his lip during today's proceedings, not just literally and figuratively as well, only uttering three words out loud inside that courtroom. Outside court, however, it was a very different story.
My son is graduating from high school, and it looks like the judge will not let me go through the graduation of my son, who's worked very, very hard. Next Thursday, we're before the United States Supreme Court at a very big hearing on immunity. And this is something that we've been waiting for a long time. And the judge, of course, is not going to allow us. He thinks he's superior, I guess, to the Supreme Court. We got a real problem with this judge.
I should note the judge that Trump is referring to there, Judge Juan Merchan, has not actually ruled yet on his request to be excused from the court for his son's graduation, which is next month. He did tell Trump, though, that he will be required to be in court next week on Thursday when those immunity arguments are going to be happening at the Supreme Court. While acknowledging that the Supreme Court is a big deal and it certainly is significant that those arguments will be taking place next week, the judge reminded Trump's team that the former president is a criminal defendant here in New York, and his presence in that courtroom, as it was today, is required. My source tonight was inside that courtroom and has reported on Trump for decades and wrote the biography of him, Confidence Man. Senior political correspondent for The New York Times and CNN's political analyst Maggie Haberman is here. And Maggie, I mean, just what a fascinating place to be reporting from today. What was it like inside the courtroom?
I mean, look, we were all, I think, very conscious that we were covering history. This was the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president. This was the beginning of jury selection. It didn't get very far in. There were a bunch of motions in the morning. But it was really striking watching Trump in this cavernous courtroom, a very, very dingy courtroom, I might add, not at all like the federal courthouses that he has, you know, become accustomed to in some of his indictments and some of his civil cases. The courtroom in 100 Center Street is really dirty, and it's really evocative of the New York that he grew up in, frankly, and pretty familiar with, but he is sitting there surrounded by initially 96 prospective jurors, and it has a minimizing effect on a guy who projects largeness and strength as often as he can. And so that was striking. He was actually on fairly good behavior compared to what we have seen in other cases and how he acted certainly in his civil cases. He has been warned by his lawyers that he could get himself in a lot of trouble, not just with the judge, but with jurors. I don't think jurors in the Carroll case liked it when he stormed out during closing arguments. We will see if he sticks to that. But it was a remarkable day.
I mean, you've covered him for so long, and to see him in that setting, you know, you've covered him when he's in the Oval Office, you've covered him on the campaign trail. To see him in a courthouse What was he doing when those 96 potential jurors came in the room? Was he looking around at them?
It's a great question. I mean, he was craning his neck to see them. In some cases, he seemed to be trying to make eye contact, which is something that he did in the Carroll case. He kept sort of scanning jurors' faces and trying to
connect. Oh, he was trying to look at them.
He was trying to connect, yeah. And in this case, when they were first, you know, the question was, do you think you can't be fair in this case? I'm paraphrasing. And it wasn't, you know, a giant show of hands. It was row by row, but it was more than 50 people who ultimately ended up leaving of this pool of 96. And Trump had the juror questionnaire in front of him as the others were then being questioned. He did look around the room as people were raising their hands and listing their jury number. They don't give their names. And then saying that they were leaving. You know, he seemed weary of it by the end of it, frankly. I mean, he seemed bored and fidgety, as we have seen him any number of times. He often can't sit still. But I think this is going to be one of the most interesting jury selection processes we've seen in a long time.
Was he reading along the questionnaire?
Mm-hmm. He was, because the way it would work is the jurors who were asked questions or asked to answer the questionnaire were seated in the jury box. And then they would just go down with the answers without saying what the question was in the interest of time, because this is such an expansive juror questionnaire. So unless you had it in front of you, you didn't really know what they were responding to until many of them said what their news reading habits were. And he was reading along to see what they were talking about.
And there's a pool in there. So there's someone sending basically dispatches to us as we're sitting outside.
And that's what I was part of, was the pool.
And you were actually in the room for that. At one point, the pool said that he was glaring at you for several seconds. You had reported shortly before that during a break that he appeared to be falling asleep at one point as the proceedings were getting kind of tedious. Did you notice that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, I noticed it. He made a pretty specific stare at me and walked out of the room.
I've been on the receiving end of said glares.
I know you have. I have too. I reported earlier that he had appeared to fall asleep. Now, we had seen him, and I want to be clear that I've seen lots of people fall asleep in courtrooms. I've seen jurors fall asleep. I've seen judges fall asleep. If anyone falls asleep who's a criminal defendant in a case, we're going to report on it. But he doesn't like when such things are reported, and I'm guessing, I don't know, that that's what this was about. I think that having to sit there and be captive while we all report on him is going to be deeply uncomfortable for him, because he is somebody who likes to control things.
And, you know, I was thinking about that today. He's always also in control of his own time. Before the White House, but certainly when you're the president of the United States, you control basically where you want to go, what you want to do. I wonder what you think it's going to be like for him to be under such time constraints of having to be in the courtroom during those Supreme Court immunity arguments next week, during other opportunities and things that he wants to be doing.
It's going to be frustrating for him, I think, on three fronts. Number one, as you said, he's not going to be able to go campaign the way he wants to campaign. He's not going to be able. Now, he has found some political benefit in these court cases, but we might be seeing the max out effect of what that looks like, depending on what happens in the trial. If he gets a hung jury in this trial, then that could look very different in terms of how it plays politically. But for argument's sake, his folks are preparing for a possible conviction. Number two, as I said before, he gets bored easily. He fidgets a lot. He has to sit there. He can't be on his phone. He can't look at Truth Social. He can't, you know, do the normal things that he does. So that, I think, is going to be taxing for him. And then there's this thing where his words are essentially weapons against him. So the thing I was really struck by in the morning was he had to sit there, and there were all these motions in the morning that were dealt with before we got to the beginning of jury selection. And in several of them, prosecutors were reading his old tweets from when he was president. And there were a series of tweets about Michael Cohen from April of 2018. And it was, Michael Cohen will never flip. And then they used it to compare tweets later, after Michael Cohen was cooperating with prosecutors. And he said something. The tweet was essentially, if you're looking for a skilled lawyer, don't hire Michael Cohen. That was the only time I saw Trump really laugh, by the way, was at his own words. But he also had to sit there as they read the transcript of the Access Hollywood tape. Not all of it, but much of it. That's what a lot of this trial is going to be.
You know what I noticed, speaking of that, is, you know, Melania Trump's not there.
Right.
This case, for all we'll talk about the legal theories with Trump's attorney who's coming on in a moment. But personally for him, it also has an impact, because it certainly did when the story was coming out and we were learning all the details of this.
There's no question. And he's been saying to people privately, you know, referencing his wife in connection with this trial about it I'm paraphrasing, but that it's not pleasant. She was very unhappy when they were in the White House. She made that very clear through a number of people. I don't expect that you will see her at this trial. We haven't seen her at any of these cases. But I do think that the personal effect of this that you're talking about is really the biggest one for him. It's a question mark as to whether even if he's convicted, he would get jail time as a first-time nonviolent offender. But he hates this case and just wants it to go away.
Maggie Haberman, stick around. We also have a pair of excellent legal sources who are joining us at the table tonight. Renato Stabile is a jury consultant who has been through this process with some high-profile defendants, from gangsters to politicians, even Harvey Weinstein. We also have Karen Friedman Agnifilo, who is a CNN legal analyst and former chief assistant DA under then-Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance. I should note, Karen is of counsel for a firm that represents Michael Cohen, but she has no contact with him, does not work on his case, and there are no restrictions on what she can say about this case. No gag order, in effect, I should say. We'll talk about what that looks like. But on the jury selection, and Maggie talking about how all those jurors raising their hands saying, I can't be impartial or fair in this, what we do know about who is still in the mix is their jobs. A salesman, an attorney, a bookseller, a prosecutor from the Bronx, a woman who works in social media, a nurse. What does that say to you about where we are at and how they're going to be going through this process?
I think, as Maggie pointed out, a criminal trial is the great equalizer, right? I spent my entire career in that very building. I've tried many cases there. I've appeared before Judge Mershon. And this jury selection is just as ordinary as any other jury selection. It takes a lot of time. People self-select to get off the jury for all hosts of reasons. I used to do sex crimes cases. You'd get more than 50% of the people saying for one reason or another they couldn't sit on a sex crimes case. And it's just that's why the clerk, Milton Tingling, who's been the clerk forever, knew to bring in 500 people to get 18 jurors, because they just it's to be expected that there are people who can't sit for 2 months. They have childcare issues or job issues. So there's lots of reasons why somebody won't serve. And so now you cull down to a few. We've now got a box of people who will be questioned starting tomorrow. And things start out slowly, like they did today, where you have to do a lot of housekeeping and ministerial type things, like although they did a lot of motion practice ahead of time to try to not have too much of a delay. There were some things they had to take care of today. And again, that always happens in the beginning of a trial.
Right.
But you'll see things start to pick up.
Well, and one question that they do have to try to kind of suss out where these jurors stand is, where do they get their news? What are they? That's what Maggie was just talking about, what they were asked. And what we were hearing from some of them, you know, one New York Times, Daily Mail, Fox News, another the New York Times, CNN, some saying, you know, Instagram, the Wall Street Journal. I mean, how is an attorney, the defense team and the prosecution, looking at those answers?
Well, you're trying to figure out their political ideology, right? That's the name of the game in this jury selection. So conventional wisdom is, if you're a fan of MSNBC, you're leaning more liberal. If you're a fan of Fox, you're leaning more conservative. So that's the purpose of those questions. But look, the reality is people watch a lot of different news sources, and they might not watch just one news source. So it tells you something, but it doesn't tell you everything.
And what we saw Trump saying there at the end about the schedule here of what this is going to look like, he was, you know, complaining that he may not be able to attend his son's graduation next month. The judge said, you know, we'll have to see what the schedule looks like. I mean, one thing was clear today is the judge does want to keep this on track.
I think the judge will allow things like that. That's very routine and very normal. I think I got the impression the judge just didn't want to rule on that today. Let's just see how that goes. But he's letting people not sit for Passover. He's already making accommodations, and those are the normal type of accommodations that this particular judge, he's a very fair, down-the-middle kind of judge. He's not known in the courtroom or the courthouse of being either pro-prosecution or pro-defense. He's very much a judge who tries to be fair and just call balls and strikes.
What did you make of the arguments over what the schedule's going to look like, how this is going? I mean, it's going to take a while first to just get the jury in and of itself.
Yeah, sure. We saw it's going very slowly right now. I mean, they didn't even get one juror. But in terms of making requests for the defendant not to be there for certain days, that's not going to happen. They might adjourn the trial for a day to accommodate various schedules, but a criminal defendant has to be there. And he's not going to just let Donald Trump not show up one day. Now, it'll be interesting to see if that actually happens. Maybe he's going to be on the campaign trail and he doesn't make it back in time. It'll be interesting to see what happens then.
Well, there's another piece of that, too, Caitlin. Excuse me one second. But I think there has been some frustration with the judge, and you saw it today, where the defense strategy has been to leverage one case against the other. And so, granted, what Todd Blanche was saying that Trump wanted to attend was a Supreme Court argument. It was not. But it was related to another one of the cases. And so the argument in Florida has been he's so busy with the Manhattan case that the Florida case can't go ahead. And the argument here was he should be allowed to have this day, even though we're so busy. And you could see Mershon's frustration with that. So I do think that he is likely, or it's much more reasonable to assume that he will allow Trump to go to his son's graduation. But the thing next week is just a different caliber.
Okay, but Maggie makes a really good point here, which is that they have been arguing with the classified documents case needs to be pushed back because we're spending so much time and effort with this case. But today they're arguing, okay, well, he can't show up to this on Thursday because he wants to attend the immunity arguments next Thursday.
Right. The judge also showed frustration today that they haven't provided a witness list, that Trump's team hasn't provided a witness list yet.
And the judge, which is unusual.
Which is very unusual. They're required to do it. And one of the issues, one of the reasons the lawyer said was because they're so busy. The Southern District just gave a big amount of discovery over at the last minute, and they're busy going through that, and they need more time. And they've got a lot going on. And the judge, you could tell, is starting to get frustrated with this. And in some of his orders, he's starting to show that delay is the goal, and he's not putting up with that.
What did you make of what they're going to be talking about tomorrow, which is Trump himself testifying? They were supposed to talk about it today. They didn't actually get to it. But it's basically, are we going to hear from him? And if not, you can't explain that later on to the jury, why he's not testifying. Is that the argument?
Well, I guess the argument is that, you know, first of all, he has an absolute right to decide whether or not he's going to testify. But if he decides not to testify, you can't make excuses to the jury about why that is. He either does or he doesn't. If he doesn't, that's fine. The jury can't draw an inference against him, but you can't tell them why it is that he wouldn't testify.
There's a huge amount of speculation out there. Trump will never testify. He'll never testify. You and I both know that he thinks he's his own best spokesman and comms director and lawyer, frankly. And so I think that even though he has no law degree, I think that if it's up to him, he will testify. I do think that they will make a decision when they see what the judge will allow prosecutors to ask or not ask. Remember, his testimony in the Carroll trial, obviously a very different situation. It was a civil trial, and it was settled already. This is not a settled case. That was about damages, mm-hmm. but the verdict was there already. It was 3 minutes, and it was very narrow, and he still went over what he was supposed to do. So I'm not sure that he will actually go ahead and do it.
Yeah, that's a great point of what this could look like and the mm-hmm. scope of what they could mm-hmm. cross-examine him on. Mm-hmm. Maggie Haberman, Renato Stabile, Karen, great to have you all here talking about all of the developments today. Up next, we're going to speak with one member of Trump's legal team to talk about his defense and what they saw that stood out today. Right now, we are also waiting for Israel's response after that brazen attack by Iran over the weekend. The question is when and how. Anderson Cooper is on the ground for us live in Tel Aviv. He'll join us shortly.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life,
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
Outside of that courthouse today, on the other side of the police barricades, were Trump supporters who had gathered outside of the courtroom. The flags with his face on them flying in the face of his claims on that Manhattan is an island populated exclusively by Biden supporters. Obviously, his folks were there as well. The crowds smaller than what we have seen at some of his past court appearances. As we note, as the Trump team has been claiming that the media attention has left New Yorkers with no way to avoid pretrial publicity. The next source tonight here on The Source is Will Scharf. He is part of the legal team who is working on the former president's immunity case and is also a Republican running in the primary to be Missouri's attorney general. So you are very busy. Thanks for joining us. You know, we were just talking about the jury selection. 32 said that they could not be, they felt like they could not be impartial. 32 jurors are still in the mix after this. I wonder what you just made of day one and how it went with your expectations.
I think it played out with respect to jury selection almost exactly as we expected. When you've had wall-to-wall media coverage in, frankly, the media capital of the world on a case like this for as long as you've had it, it's going to be very tough to find people who can come into the courtroom without preconceived biases about the evidence, about the law, who will accept the judge's instructions and who will view the facts dispassionately. I think we saw that with a number of jurors who basically pulled themselves out of consideration at the start. And I think it's going to be very difficult to seat an unbiased jury here for all of those reasons. And we're going to see that play out over the next couple weeks.
But there were, you know, over 30 that still believed that they could be fair and impartial. I mean, y'all will get the chance to question them going forward. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there is a group that says, yeah, I can do this. I can put aside, you know, whatever my beliefs are.
And the point of the voir dire process is to really assess whether jurors are going to be able to do their duty as jurors, whether they're going to be able to set aside preconceived notions. And with a defendant like President Trump, who's probably one of the most famous people in the world, if not the most famous person in the world, it's very difficult to find jurors who come into the courtroom without preconceived notions about what the evidence may or may not be.
Yeah, but you may have some who are pro-Trump and don't agree with the evidence. So what are you going to be looking for? What will these jurors be being asked by the Trump defense team?
Well, look, we want jurors who will dispassionately view the evidence and rule according to what is presented in the courtroom, and not what they may have heard on a TV show or what they may have read online. We're looking for fair and unbiased jurors because we believe the facts and the law are on our side here. I would say with respect to the jury pool itself, I mean, we've consistently moved for a change of venue of this case because New York, one, it's the media capital of the world. It's also a place where President Trump does not have many political supporters. Politically, this is a very, very bad jurisdiction for him. And for this trial to be occurring at the height of the presidential election season, it's almost impossible for it to occur without some sort of bleeding over of political animus. And that's really our biggest fear.
It sounds like you're making an argument to kind of set yourself up for an appeal. Is that the case?
I think we're going to win at trial. Obviously, if we have appealable issues, we have every right to appeal those issues.
You think you're going to win this case ultimately?
I think if the jury decides based on the facts and the law, there's no way that President Trump can be convicted.
Does the legal team agree that former President Trump should take the stand?
I think that's going to be a question for President Trump and the trial team based on how the trial goes. A defendant obviously has every right to take the stand in his own defense. He also has every right not to. And the prosecution is not allowed to try to get the jury to form any inference based on a decision one way or the other.
Yeah, what do you personally think? Do you think he should get up there?
Well, as one of his attorneys, my personal view really isn't in question.
What's your legal advice to me?
I would say I think President Trump would be a very compelling witness in this case. I think his testimony would be able to explain, as other witnesses' testimony would, that he did nothing wrong here.
You were saying earlier to my colleague Jake Tapper that you believe that the judge can't be a fair judge here. But when we were listening to those back and forth maneuvers this morning over what evidence can be allowed to the extent of it, I mean, he ruled in your favor at some points. So do you not believe that he's fair when he makes decisions like that?
We've moved to recuse Judge Merchan off of this case. We believe that he has irretrievable biases that under New York law require recusal. It's also important to note that in the seminal case on judicial recusal, the Supreme Court's Caperton v. Massey, they held that even the appearance of impropriety, given sufficiently extreme facts, can justify recusal. He disagreed with that, and we disagree with him, and that's an issue that we'll have to see play out as this case proceeds.
But the point is, I think, you know, y'all were making arguments today, the Trump team, the prosecutors are making arguments. At some points, he agreed with the prosecutors, and at some points, he agreed with the Trump defense team on what can be allowed in there.
Well, but, I mean, the fact that he sided with us on a given evidentiary ruling or not doesn't address the underlying bias, which we believe is severe and which we believe requires recusal here.
You were saying that if the jury pays attention to the facts of this case, that you believe ultimately you will win. Which facts are those that you believe will ultimately win you this case?
Well, look,
the question is what Trump knew about payments and how they were labeled.
Well, this is a case that's consistently been labeled the Trump hush money trial. And that's a total misnomer and a total mischaracterization of what this case is about. This case is about business records charges. The question is whether business records relating to payments made to Michael Cohen were misrecorded, whether recording payments to one of President Trump's lawyers as legal retainer payments was improper. There's also a serious factual question about the level of involvement President Trump himself had with the recording of those business records. And then on top of that, for this to be a felony, as it's been charged, they would need to show that the reason those business records were incorrectly recorded was to cover up another crime. Now, that aspect of this case, this election fraud aspect of it, I think that the idea that these payments could have plausibly been election expenses just doesn't mesh with federal law on what's allowable in that context. And that's why the Biden Department of Justice, the FEC, and Cy Vance himself, the previous New York DA, have all declined to take action on either this case or very similar legal theories.
Can I stop you there and ask you, because you just mentioned a legal retainer fee here. I mean, how do you dispute that when Rudy Giuliani is on television from that time period saying Michael Cohen wasn't doing any legal work for Donald Trump at this time? And Rudy Giuliani said Trump was aware generally of the arrangement that he had with Michael Cohen to make payments like this to cover up these stories.
Well, and I think your question points to exactly the problem we have with jury bias here, that there's been so much press coverage and so many people have said so many different things about the underlying facts.
Rudy Giuliani was his attorney. It's not just a commentator who doesn't know anything. Rudy Giuliani, you know, I was at the White House that time. I was at the White House. Rudy Giuliani would be on the White House grounds. Like, he knew what was going on.
The jury is going to have to make a decision based on the evidence they hear in the courtroom. And that's a linchpin of our system of law and order. It's a linchpin of our courts. It's a linchpin of the Constitution. I think what Rudy Giuliani may or may not have said years ago really doesn't bear on this case. The facts are the facts, and I think the truth is on our side.
But how do you dispute what his own attorney at the time was saying, I guess is my question.
How do you push back on that? Caitlin, I'm not familiar with the statements in question, but I do know what the facts are in this case. And Michael Cohen was one of President Trump's lawyers. Payments to Michael Cohen were booked as legal retainer payments. Whether that's inaccurate or not is ultimately going to be a question for the jury. I don't believe those were inaccurate recordings. And I also don't believe that Trump personally made those recordings. And that's another fact that's going to have to be developed as the trial goes on.
Trump's involvement, which, you know, Michael Cohen will testify they did. But can I just, I'm genuinely curious.
And I'm somewhat limited in what I can say about Michael Cohen because of the gag order, the unconstitutional gag order that's been placed against us.
Well, the gag order just says Trump can't attack a witness, Michael Cohen.
That's correct. It says that I can't speak about what his testimony might be or really get into a lot of details I would otherwise like to. I will say, though, and we've said this in legal pleadings, that numerous previous courts have found Michael Cohen to be a perjurer. And that's going to be a credibility question that's going to be placed squarely in front of the jury.
Can I play this Rudy Giuliani just moment for you? Because
sure.
I am curious as an attorney for the team for Trump, what you make of what he said on Fox News a few years ago.
When I heard Cohen's retainer of $35,000, when he was doing no work for the president, I said, well, that's how he's repaying. That's how he's repaying it, with a little profit and a little margin for paying taxes for Michael. He did know about the general arrangement that Michael would take care of things like this.
I mean, if they play a moment like that in court, what does the defense argue?
Well, again, one, that's not evidence. And two, I don't think those are the facts. I think that these were payments being made to one of President Trump's lawyers that were recorded as legal retainer payments. And I don't believe that was an inaccurate recording. I think the core of this case is whether that recording constituted business records fraud. And under New York law, I just don't think it did.
Yeah, just interesting since Rudy Giuliani is saying he wasn't doing legal work for him. Will Scharf, we'll see how it all plays out in court once there actually is a jury that has been gathered and paneled. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, speaking of the Republican presidential nominee, the presumptive one, he is campaigning from a court today, hoping voters will sympathize with him. The question is, what does it actually mean for the campaign trail? Also, President Biden's response when he was asked today if he's watching the coverage. While Donald Trump was sitting in a New York courtroom today, President Biden was in the Oval Office. And at one point, he was asked whether or not he is going to be weighing in on his likely opponent's legal troubles.
President Biden, you watching any of the Trump trial?
Thank you, press. We have to move out now, so we're going to move out.
If you look closely there, you can see the president shook his head. No. The Biden campaign has kind of taken a virtual vow of silence on Trump's court dates. Here tonight, former deputy assistant to President Biden, Jamal Simmons, also Trump's former White House communications director, Alyssa Farah Griffin. And Jamal, President Biden kind of gave this, you know, we're not going to talk about it. His campaign did put out a statement tonight alluding to what happened today, saying, wake up, Donald. After stormy abortion ban coverage, Trump poll memo attempts to hush panic. I think they're choosing their words carefully there. What do you make of how, you know, if you were still in the White House, how you'd advise them to handle this, though?
Oh, I think they're handling it the right way, which is to stay away from it. An old rule of politics is, you know, when your opponent is sticking himself in the eye with a fork, don't try to stop him. Don't get in the way. And that's sort of what's happening right now. You've got a former president of the United States who is in a criminal trial, at the end of which he could be branded a convicted felon. The last thing you want to do is give him any more rhetorical ammunition to say that Biden is somehow behind this or benefiting from it.
Yeah, because, I mean, you just saw they have been connecting all of this to the Biden Justice Department. Trump was doing it earlier. Trump is fundraising off of this as well. I should note they were saying he stormed out of the court earlier, which he had not. But they were sending out a lot of fundraising emails today as this was going on, Alyssa.
Yeah, remarkably, I still receive them. Listen, he's missing a lot of time on the campaign trail, so he's going to have to make up for it how he can. He's going to fundraise off of it. He's on air in key battleground states. But I think as remarkable as this is just stepping back, you know, this is who Republican voters decided they wanted to be the nominee. But prime time on a Monday night, you know, 6+ months out from an election, we're talking about his trials. We're not talking about his campaign platform, his second term agenda. And this is what the next stretch is going to look like. If it's not this, it's going to move on to the question over immunity on the Supreme Court and then potentially onto the January 6th trial. And there is going to be fatigue with voters. Now, I've said many times, I don't think many Republicans care a whole lot about this case. I think they made their peace with whatever wrongdoing may have been there back in 2016. But they are just going to get weary of the fact he's not talking about their issues. He's out there at a courtroom, not on the campaign trail, not showing up to vote for voters.
You know, given that, I was so surprised to hear what Governor Chris Sununu said over the weekend. I mean, our viewers will be very familiar with all of his criticisms of Donald Trump and his strength as the Republican nominee when he was out campaigning for Nikki Haley. He was asked about all of that this weekend, and this is what he had to say to George Stephanopoulos.
You support him for president even if he's convicted in classified documents. You support him for president even though you believe he contributed to an insurrection. You support him for president even though you believe he's lying about the last election. You'd support him for president even if he's convicted in the Manhattan case. I just want to say the answer to that is yes, correct?
Yeah, me and 51% of America.
I mean, even if he's a convicted felon, if he is the Republican nominee, does that mean you're still going to vote for him?
Look, I think right now most of America, it looks like they would vote for him because he's winning.
But what about
okay,
you,
so
Governor?
Most of America is right there. Yeah, I'm going to support the Republican nominee. Absolutely.
Okay, so that was him in January. And then George kind of just was listing all of the factors that are now part of it. I mean,
listen, Governor Sununu is a friend. On this, we just fundamentally disagree. Donald Trump remains unfit to be president, but also the second point that Sununu kind of makes there, which is like, I care about a Republican administration. He's not running on a conservative platform by any means. That's why his own former vice president, a consummate conservative, Mike Pence, is saying, I'm not going to be supporting him this time around. He's running away from commitments that he made in the first term and is frankly just not running as a Republican. So I have no problem myself saying I will never support him, but it's remarkable seeing people go back.
As someone who is hoping to get those independent, centrist-minded Republicans over on your side of the aisle, what did you hear on that?
Oh, this is just clearly political expediency, right? But I don't understand why people feel they have to be politically expedient when it comes to Donald Trump. I'm hearing a lot of reports from friends who are working on campaigns in states. They're not seeing a lot of evidence of Republican coordinated campaigns that are taking place. Republican state candidates are leery of doing joint fundraising agreements with the Republican National Committee. There's still some back and forth between who worked for who in the primary and whether or not you can get a job. The infighting that's taking place around this candidacy, it's just mind-boggling about how you're going to run not only a presidential campaign, but if you want to run for the Senate, want to run for Congress, want to run for county commissioner, how do you do that in an environment where the top of the ticket is a felon and you can't count on them to do anything to support the rest of the people running as Republicans?
TBD, he may not be a felon. We will see what happens. Jamal Simmons, Alyssa Farah Griffin, thank you both for being here tonight. Up next, we'll go live to the ground in Israel, where leaders are right now vowing to make Iran pay a price for that massive assault over the weekend. The U.S. and other allies are urging restraint from Israel. Is a response coming soon? Anderson Cooper is there with the very latest.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Tonight, there are major concerns that Israel's response to Iran's brazen attack could explode into a full-fledged war. Israel's army chief told soldiers today that there will be a response, and that statement came after Israeli officials got into a heated debate over what that response should look like. A source tells CNN they are united in their belief to act and to do so quickly. For the first time ever, Iran, instead of one of its proxies that they fund, launched a direct attack on Israeli soil with more than 300 drones and missiles targeting Israel on Saturday. It caused massive alarm at the White House and sent President Biden home early from his trip to Delaware to go to monitor everything from the Situation Room. Iran's leader said it was punishment for the IDF's attacks on the Iranian consulate in Syria earlier this month that killed Iranian commanders. Most of those projectiles from Iran were intercepted by Israel and its partners, including the United States. And I want to bring in Anderson Cooper, who is on the ground in Tel Aviv tonight. And Anderson, you know, obviously this attack from Iran, this attempted attack, was targeting an Israeli air base where Iran says Israel's strike on the consulate was launched from. I mean, given what they were targeting and what they were going after, how is Israel's war cabinet weighing that when deciding how they're going to respond here?
I think there's certainly a lot of factors going into what's, you know, what's being weighed. First of all, you know, the timing of a response. Is it something that should occur right away? Is it something that will be done down the road at a time and a target of their choosing? There is some thought, certainly, that the longer they wait, whatever sympathy and goodwill there is right now toward Israel because they have come under attack, that might dissipate by the time there is a later attack. So that would be sort of pushing for an attack sooner rather than later. Then there's question is whether would there be an attack directly to Iran? Would it be to Hezbollah, Iranian-backed Hezbollah forces in Lebanon or elsewhere? So I think there's a lot of different considerations. And also, would a target be something that they would want to try to maximize and make sure that there were no civilians or, you know, very limited actual fatalities involved? It would be against more of a facility, given the limited number of fatalities that occurred or injuries that occurred here in Israel. So I think there's a lot in consideration. But the chief of staff, the IDF today, made clear that there will be a response. We don't know if the war cabinet has made a decision about the exact nature of that response, though.
Well, and I mean, that response could either escalate what is happening in the region or de-escalate it potentially. I mean, and Israel's still fighting another war in Gaza. How much of this is having an impact on how they're conducting their operations in Gaza? I know you've been speaking with IDF officials about this.
Yeah, I talked to IDF spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner earlier today. You know, our Jeremy Diamond had been reporting that Israel had planned to begin to drop leaflets in Rafah, in southern Gaza, starting today, telling people that they had to leave that area in advance of a ground operation in Rafah, which would have likely occurred later on this week. That did not occur today, which seems to indicate perhaps that whatever plan there may have been for a Rafah operation, that may be on hold or delayed for now because of what happened. I asked Colonel Lerner about that. He wouldn't say whether or not that operation is on hold, but he did stress that the road to getting hostages released, the road to the destruction of Hamas, which is still the stated purpose of the Israeli operation in Gaza, that road goes through Rafah. Here's what he said.
If we want to fulfill our mission of dismantling Hamas as a governing entity and bringing home the hostages, they still hold 133 hostages in Gaza. The road to fulfilling those objectives goes through Rafah.
The other thing to consider, of course, Caitlin, is right now there is this sympathy for Israel on the international stage. You have the United States, European allies, other countries expressing support for Israel. The focus is not on Gaza for right now. If Israel was to go forward with that Rafah operation, obviously some of that international support would start to lessen and weaken. That's another consideration here on the ground.
Yeah, a lot hanging in the balance. Anderson Cooper in Tel Aviv, thank you. And in Washington, there's the prospect of a coming vote on aid to Israel and to Ukraine as well. It's now setting off Republican firebrand Marjorie Taylor Greene with a new threat to oust the House Speaker Mike Johnson over his latest proposal. The question is whether the showdown in the House has arrived. We'll give you a live report right after this. Tonight, a new warning coming from Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican congresswoman from Georgia, says that the House Speaker Mike Johnson could be near the end of his speakership, in her view, if he moves forward to pass a series of bills, including aid for Ukraine.
He's definitely not going to be Speaker next Congress if we're lucky enough to have the majority. And I think that is widely held belief throughout the conference.
Is he going to be Speaker for the rest of this Congress, do you think?
That is to be determined.
Speaker Johnson, meanwhile, dismissed those threats.
I don't spend my time worrying about motions to vacate. We're having to govern here, and we're going to do our job.
I want to bring in Josh Rogan, foreign policy columnist for The Washington Post. And Josh, I mean, to hear this fight that has been kind of simmering on Capitol Hill and Speaker Johnson saying he's not worried about these threats, but bringing these aid bills to the floor, depending on what happens, could potentially remove him from that job.
Well, that's right, Caitlin, and I hate to contradict the speaker, but according to my sources, he is worried about those threats. He's very worried about them, and he spends a lot of time thinking about how to keep his job. And this latest gambit by Speaker Johnson, which was just released tonight, is his scheme to try to get Israel aid, Ukraine aid, Taiwan aid, plus a bunch of other stuff passed without losing his job. And that's to avoid the motion to vacate that's being threatened by Marjorie Taylor Greene. And frankly, I don't think it's going to work. Marjorie Taylor Greene said it's not going to work. She's going to go forward with it if he goes forward with his plan. Plus, the whole idea that he put forth, which is that you pass all of these bills separately and then join them together at the end and then send them over to the Senate, is kind of harebrained. It's really complicated. It makes sense on paper, but in real life, it may not actually even work. So I think that what we're seeing is that until she actually does it, Marjorie Taylor Greene has all of this leverage. Once she actually does it, she loses the leverage. So while she has this threat hanging over Johnson's head like a sword of Damocles, he's dancing. And, you know, once she actually pulls the trigger, I think, you know, yeah, it's very possible that others could join her.
Well,
and
can I get your perspective on the other side of the political aisle, which is, you know, obviously these are separate bills for Israel, for Ukraine, for Taiwan, a fourth one that's kind of a GOP, everything, you know, priorities. This is top of mind for President Biden as well, who's been weighing in on this and, you know, waiting to see. He and Speaker Johnson spoke about this plan, I should note. But we saw today these pro-Palestinian protests playing out across the United States today in major cities, in New York, Chicago, and Oakland. They shut down the Golden Gate Bridge for several hours, I should note, before, you know, we saw any arrests happen. I mean, this is also determining, you know, what this is going to look like for the White House and how they handle this.
Well, that's right. President Biden is torn between his desire to get the Ukraine aid passed, which means he's got to deal with the Republicans. And in fact, the White House is dealing with the Speaker's office pretty well in negotiating this stuff. And on the other hand, a lot of Democrats don't want to support the Israel aid for all the reasons that you just laid out. And that's sort of the theory by which this Johnson scheme makes sense, which is you let everybody vote for the different parts. And then some Democrats can vote against Israel aid and some Republicans can vote against Ukraine aid, but it's really complicated. And, you know, it doesn't solve the bind that President Biden is in. Either he's going to support Israel or he's going to move towards the progressive side. He can't do both. And he's eventually going to have to choose.
We'll see what that looks like, of course, as we creep closer to the election as well. Josh Rogan, great to have you. Thank you.
Anytime.
And this just in to CNN, another historic tonight for the all another t- first tonight, I should note, for the already historic resume of basketball's Caitlin Clark.
With the first pick in the 2024 WNBA draft, the Indiana Fever select Caitlin Clark, University of Iowa.
Caitlin Clark is the all-time leading scorer, of course, in the NCAA Division I basketball history. Ticket prices to watch the Fever in Indy this season more than doubled
After Clark announced that she would enter the draft, it was obvious she was going to likely be the first number one pick, and she spoke to Coy Wire just beforehand.
I'm super excited. I know this will be super special, and I have a lot of family coming. My coaches are coming. Some of my teammates are coming. So just getting to enjoy it and soak it in, I think, is the biggest thing, because, like, this is once in a lifetime. This only happens once.
Also worth noting tonight, LSU's Angel Reese went six picks later as the Chicago Sky second pick. Thank you all so much for joining us. Congrats to both of them and everyone in the WNBA draft tonight. CNN News Night with Abby Phillip starts right now.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.